dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go right.
You're listening to episode 656 of Unwelcome Guests, The Secret Wars of the CIA. I'm Robin Upton, and you're going to hear a single presentation this week. This is a talk by CIA whistleblower John Stockwell at American University on the 3rd of November, 1989.
Let me begin by correcting a minor detail, and this is not the fault of my host. I'm not the highest-ranking CIA officer to go public. There have been CIA directors going public all the time. I think I have the distinction of being one of the highest case officers to go public and endeavor to tell the truth about what the CIA has been up to. We're going to talk about that tonight, the CIA secret wars, but what I've done over the years since I left the agency is to pursue in my readings the broader subjects of how the CIA secret wars, to understand them for sure, and show how they interrelate to the broader problems that also affect, or perhaps really affect, our national security interests. Tonight we're going to talk about the secret wars of the CIA and the nuclear arms race in the age of glasnost with an ex-CIA director for president. We've got Mikhail Gorbachev's policies of openness on the one hand and George Bush on the other side saying we're a kinder and more humane nation. They're telling us that the communist bloc is breaking apart, the Cold War is over, the arms race is over. And if this were altogether true, it would be absolutely wonderful. Unfortunately, our world is still fraught with some grievous problems. Our planet is still booby-trapped with 60,000 thermonuclear weapons, and our factories are still producing them as fast as ever and testing and developing them as vigorously as ever. We've just gotten through spending $2.2 trillion, and that's a conservative figure that's been published, on the largest arms buildup in the history of the world, at least at peace, and coincidentally increased our national debt. We were not a debtor nation before, by about the same amount of $2 trillion. The United States still has an open policy of supporting coups and destabilizations and low-intensity conflicts in every corner of the globe, the U.S. doing this through the CIA, my old organization. And as you all well know, our society is said to be drowning in a sea of drugs, and integral to all of this is the systematic destruction of our environment. And it's my thesis that these subjects interrelate. Drug trafficking, the arms race, conventional wars, the destruction of the environment, and the killing of the United States president in 1963, and the CIA secret wars, all of these things are interwoven together. And it's my purpose tonight to try to give you, in 1 hour, a sense of how these things interrelate. It's a vast subject, a dense subject. I can't possibly do justice to it in the time allowed. This means I'm going to have to insult your intelligence by skimming across the top of subjects that you could get a PhD dissertation written in and still not cover thoroughly. So all I can do is just try my best. And in the question and answer, I'll stay with you a goodly time taking questions in detail on the areas that you want to pursue in greater detail. I also publish a bibliography, and we'll put the address up here where you can order copies of it, of the best 120 books that I've found on the subject, and I have a brief review of each of the books in it and some introductory remarks that may help you to pursue this subject. Mind you, we have thousands of books have been written about national security and world security and U.S. security, and these are merely the best 120 books that I've found on the subject. This massive documentation, of course, is the salvation of the intellectually attuned. I urge you to read for yourselves. Do not take anything I'm saying tonight as the gospel. I'm telling you that our leaders lie to us. They lie to us systematically. They lie to us with a purpose that may not be your purpose. Some of their lies, if you're a young man, may motivate you to go off someday and die, be killed, or to kill people. And the only way you can defend yourself against other people programming you, because we are programmable. Marine Corps boot camp taught me that. They can teach you and get you fired up, rah, 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 and then say charge, and you'll charge up the hill without asking why, and perhaps not come down the hill feet first. The French have a saying that I mangle in translation, them that don't do politics will be done. If you don't defend yourself by filling your mind with a true understanding of what's happening in the world, then others will fill it up for you, and then at some point in time, use the information and the conditioning that they've planted in your mind and breast to use you, if you will. Once again, I have a bibliography. I urge you to read for yourself. I urge you to reach inside the books and go to their bibliographies and pursue the subject on beyond and travel and inform yourselves. We're going to take Nicaragua tonight. We're going to get into these awesome subjects of the arms race and whatnot from my specialty, which was CIA's activities. I was a manager in three of the CIA's so-called secret wars or low-intensity conflicts or whatever you would call them. We're going to start with them, of course, and we're going to start with Nicaragua as a case study because it's particularly timely, because the elections are coming up, because we've been beating up on Nicaragua for the last 10 years. And coincidentally, because it's very much in the news right now, today, tonight, during this last week. In fact, the Washington Post has special op-eds on it and editorial pieces on it today. I was just reading them in my hotel room. The Contras have moved several thousand armed fighters down into the country, but the State Department says they're not there to fight. They're just down there to encourage people to vote. But they're killing... But they're killing people, and Ortega sees his responsibility as trying to stop people from killing people in his country. He's doing exactly what President George Bush would do if there were a force in this country gunning people down. And so he has said that this ceasefire is no longer a ceasefire. And our media, the State Department Post and the other newspapers that are published in this city and elsewhere, are all falling right into line with the propaganda lines of attacking Ortega and trying to use his actions to put him under political pressure to discredit him, if they can, to the degree they can. Now, another reason we're picking Nicaragua for a case study is because it's just particularly useful of all the hundreds of CIA operations that we could dissect. And mind you, Angola is in the news. And I was once chief of the Angola Task Force on a subcommittee of the National Security Council called the Interagency Working Group, commanding, although I was working closely under the supervision of Jim Potts of the Africa Division and Henry Kissinger and the CIA Director Bill Colby. And Angola is very much in the news, and Savimbi was just in town, and I'm also clearly tempted to talk about Angola. But Nicaragua is a better example because it's closer to the United States culturally and physically. And because this covert action destabilization that we've run against Nicaragua has been open on both ends. Usually these things are closed. Usually our government is covering them and hiding them to the greatest degree it can. And the country we're attacking becomes hostile and paranoid and seals its borders. In the case of Nicaragua, until last year, until quite recently, it had a policy of remaining open. Anyone from the states who wanted to go down and have a look could do so without getting a visa. Meanwhile, in Washington, the thing was debated quite openly for more aid and details of the aid and abuse of the aid and the little gradations of rules we put on how the aid could be spent. So we knew it from both ends. And during the entire period of the 80s, I was traveling back and forth from Washington to Nicaragua to elsewhere, informing myself to assess this thing and also using the material in my lectures. Also, unlike Angola, there was never a chance in Angola that we would make it into another Vietnam, putting in U.S. troops seriously. And this was a very real possibility in Nicaragua during the mid-80s. It's a remote possibility today. The U.S., of course, as you know, has had a fixation on Nicaragua since the mid-1800s. It's been the issue of a second canal or a better canal, of different interests trying to develop it, of military interventions, of putting the Marines in there a half a dozen times to occupy it, to dominate it, to force elections, to control events in that country. The Marines were eventually withdrawn in 1933 as a result of the international pressure of the international peace movement, and at that time we switched into a more subtle phase of the ancient Monroe Doctrine, where instead of using Marines so much with gunboat diplomacy, We created a National Guard with officers trained at our academies here in the States, and then maintained control of the country by proxy without taking the heat for having our troops inside the country itself. It's been said that this event was the birth of neocolonialism. This also was the kickoff of the U.S. policy of establishing a military oligarchy. We set up schools and trained tens of thousands of military and police officers in countries all over Latin America and Africa in some cases, and Asia, putting them through our academies, arming them, paying their salaries afterwards, trying to create and successfully creating a situation where we would have a fraternity of people in these countries in power who were more loyal to the fraternity of our own military than they were to the peasants and people of their own countries. Meanwhile, this cat and mouse game that we've played with Nicaragua since 1981 is a classic case of what CI directors more recently themselves called destabilization. The point is to put pressure on the targeted government by ripping apart the social and economic fabric of the country. Now that's words, you know, social and economic fabric. That means making the people suffer as much as you can until the country plunges into chaos, until at some point you can step in and impose your choice of governments on that country. The rationales we've used in Nicaragua are classic. We've been fighting communism. It's been national security. They're a Marxist bastion in our own backyard and all of that. More specifically, our leaders have said at first that the purpose of this program was to interdict the flow of arms from Nicaragua to the rebels in El Salvador. Unable to prove any flow of arms whatsoever from Nicaragua into El Salvador, they eventually got into the line which they used in the last few years of returning Nicaragua to democracy. And then we pointed out to them that Nicaragua never had a democracy, certainly not under the Somoza dictatorships. So they call it the democratization of Nicaragua, ignoring the fact that Nicaragua, by the way, had elections in 1984 that were much more democratic than the elections that we had in this republic. We don't live in a democracy in the United States itself. Now, we, I submit, will never know exactly what the Sandinistas would have done with this country of Nicaragua if we had left them alone to react to the country's problems according to their own interests and ideology and compulsions. We do know, however, that they abolished the death sentence at exactly the same time the United States was reinstituting the death sentence in this country. Maximum penalty in their courts is 30 years in jail. They released thousands of the hated National Guard that they had in their custody, saying that they would not jail anyone for having belonged to an organization. They would have to be convicted of individual crimes. They launched a literacy campaign to teach each Nicaraguan to read and write. They set out to build 2,500 clinics so each Nicaraguan would have access to some kind of medical treatment. These are all things that Somoza the dictator, backed up by the United States, had not gotten around to doing. And they launched the most ambitious land reform campaign in the history of Central America. And they did this by maintaining a free enterprise economy. If you owned land and you were working it, you kept it. They were taking the lands that Somoza and his family and the people who had fled had stolen or taken or gotten, and they were turning those lands back to the people in different forms and cooperatives, feeling their way as they went, making mistakes as they went, trying this solution and that one, but with the purpose of getting the land back to the people so people would work land, own land, relate to land, and profit from the land that they worked on in their own country. And they brought something totally new, I believe, to the modern world, which is a unity between Christianity and Marxism, of asserting that the church should have, if it has any purpose and justification at all, it's that it should be the church of the people, the church of the poor, not the church of the oligarchy and the rich and the wealthy. I've been in Tomas Borges' office, the Minister of Interior, and counted on the wall the 25 Catholic icon collector items that he's put on the wall there. If he had counted them twice, there were exactly 25. That infers that he must have others at home, and these were the selected ones that he put on, that he chose to display on his wall. And until today, despite this continued attack, war is what the World Court called it, that we've waged on Nicaragua, Nicaragua has yet to commit one act of war against the United States. But instead of joining them in building the healthiest, most dynamic, most enthusiastic country in Central America, we spent over $1 billion during the 80s to destabilize the country. We set out systematically to create conditions where the farmer could not get his produce to market, where children couldn't go to school, where women were terrified inside their homes as well as outside their homes of being attacked, where the hospitals were treating wounded people instead of sick people, where government administration grinds to a halt, where the trucks don't run, the bridges are bloated, the salaries aren't paid, you can't get a driver's license, all the infrastructure breaks down, and of course eventually international capital is scared away and the country plunges into chaos and bankruptcy. We created the Contra program beginning in about 1981. There was a Newsweek article following up, if there was plenty of documentation on this, on November 7 and 8, 1982, that said, here we go again. We've done this before. It's been a mistake before. We're going into Nicaragua. Once again, we're supporting the wrong side, Newsweek noted. It said that we had elected to support the only truly evil, totally unacceptable faction in the Nicaraguan equation, that being the remnants of Somoza's hated National Guard. But using Argentine trainers at first and then eventually CIA mercenaries, we armed and directed this small army from bases mostly in Honduras to attack in Nicaragua and destabilize. Systematically, they were blowing up granaries, sawmills, bridges, government offices, schools, health centers, mines, mining roads, ambushing trucks, raiding farms and villages. We have massive documentation of all this because the country, as I said, was kept open. For the first few years, CBS, NBC, ABC, BBC, CBC all had crews down there in residence, and when there would be atrocities, they would rush up and film them. We also had what totaled eventually dozens of thousands of witnesses from this country and Canada and Europe and Australia going down and living right in the towns and villages with the people, and when there were atrocities, rushing out to film and photograph and document them. Like I say, massive documentation. There's also been direct U.S. military involvement in all of this. U.S. military mining harbors, overflights, underwater demolitions teams going in to blow up things in the ports. There's been assassination of religious leaders, teachers, health workers, elected officials, government administrators. CBS, NBC, others have footage of this. The America's Watch, the Witness for Peace, we've managed to come up with lists of the names of hundreds and hundreds of leaders who've been assassinated down there. We also have admission of this program by President Ronald Reagan on national television in the debates with Walter Mondale, because an assassination manual that we were using to train these people, the Contras with, was brought to the attention of the press, and it became a big issue and led to a change, a slight change, in the politics in Congress towards the Contra program. And President Reagan said this was the work of the CIA station chief in Tegucigalpa, and I can assure you the CIA was not appreciative of him, you know, with that particular slip-up. Because one, it attributed, you know, assassinations, a policy of... So the media went to the White House the next, the following Monday and said, did that mean that there had been a change in U.S. policy against assassinations? And the White House, playing, you know, doublespeak, said, well, no, not really, because in our opinion, assassination applies to world leaders only. When you're killing religious leaders or regional leaders, it's not assassination, it's just killing. Terror has been a part of this program, raw terror, as raw as anything that happens in the Middle East or elsewhere. These Contras have been going into villages, they've been hauling families out, with other members of the family forced to watch. They've been castrating fathers, gang raping mothers, slashing off their breasts again while the children are forced to watch. 22,000 is the figure the New York Times gave the last time I counted as the number of people killed in this thing. And again, this is nobody's propaganda. This is documented and condemned by the World Court, by the Presbyterian Church, by the Methodist Church, by broad segments of the Catholic Church, and again by these dozens of thousands of witnesses who've gone down from other countries to see for themselves. As you recall, President Reagan remained throughout unapologetic for this activity. He took pride in saying, quote, I'm a Contra. He took pride in saying that these people were the moral equivalent of his founding fathers. And of course, George Bush has never missed a chance to identify himself with these Contras. Again, read for yourself. Read Contra Terror by Reed Brody, former Assistant Attorney General of New York State. Read The Contras by Dieter Eich. Read With the Contras by Christopher Dickey, a so-called moderate journalist representing the Washington Post in Central America. Read Witness for Peace, What We Have Seen and Heard. Read The Lawyers Commission on Human Rights. Read The Violations of War on Both Sides by the America's Watch. Read The Mosquito Indians in Nicaragua. Read Washington's War on Nicaragua by Holly Sklar. Or go to Nicaragua and see for yourself. You have to get a visa now, but there's not one person in this room who cannot find a way in the coming summer, for example, or during the winter even, to raise enough money to go to Nicaragua and see for yourself. And I urge you to do so because we have a unique situation. It may be 10 or 20 years before there'll be another covert action, which is so open that you can be sure of the facts, you can have absolute knowledge of what your government is doing there, and you can go inside the country and circulate and see the effects of our destabilization policy on the targeted country. Of course, throughout these years, there's been a relentless propaganda program to discredit the Sandinistas. We've labeled the Sandinistas as totalitarian dictators. We said at first that they were flowing arms into El Salvador. We claimed when they put together a military machine to defend their country from this attack, we claimed they were building a war machine that, quote, threatened the stability of all of Central America, without noting that they did not have strategic weapons. They did not have tanks and bombers that could, in fact, attack other countries. We charged them with censorship, specifically closing down La Prensa newspaper, and it was several years after we were crowing about this censorship by the government before it came out that La Prensa was on the United States government payroll. The National Endowment for Democracy, using U.S. government funds, was subsidizing La Prensa as our propaganda arm right in the capital of that country while we brutally destabilized that country. And of course, in 1984, we launched a vigorous campaign to discredit their elections. Now, they had elections that were supervised and witnessed by United Nations groups and other groups who said that they were as fair as any elections they had seen in Central America in many, many years. And these elections were quite an embarrassment to Ronald Reagan, who was then the champion of the Contra program in this country, and I'm sure to George Bush today, because they were quite a bit more democratic than the elections that we held in this country during the same year. I suggest you go to the Covert Action Information Bulletin number 25 from the summer of 1986. There are later versions of the bulletin being sold outside tonight, for an article by Mr. Michael Parenti discussing the democracy in Nicaragua. They had seven parties with candidates running for election. We had two. They turned out 75.4% of the vote. We turned out 53% of the vote in this country. They voted directly. We voted for electors who selected our leaders. They passed a law that every legitimate party would have an equal amount of money to spend for campaign purposes. In this country, if you can raise more money, you can buy more television time, you have a much better chance of winning the election. In fact, in terms of direct voter participation in this republic, we are not a democracy, we're a republic. In terms of voter representation, we're rated 75th in the world, just before South Africa, which is 76th. Another element of propaganda that we were slamming them with was claiming that the Sandinistas were smuggling drugs to finance their revolution. We staged scenes paying the pilot Barry Seals, plea bargaining a deal with him to land a plane in Nicaragua, to kick some bales of marijuana out on the runway, to photograph by satellite so President Reagan could put them on television saying, this proves they're smuggling drugs. In fact, the record is out massively clear. The Contra program was smuggling drugs. I won't go into the details right here now in the question and answer. We will. I'll mention them later. But we had the Senator Kerry investigation. We had also intensive investigation by our media. We have dozens of cases where people in the Contra program, including Adolfo Calero's brother-in-law, caught smuggling cocaine into this country using the national security shield or passes, using telephone numbers from the pass from the White House to get themselves cleared when FBI or DEA officers would come down on them. We claim the Sandinistas were responsible for terrorism in Central America. And this case, of course, has never been made. Meanwhile, however, the United States has been supporting with literally billions of dollars the activities of death squads that were slaughtering people brutally in countries like El Salvador and Guatemala. And we've been blaming the Sandinistas for the misery in Nicaragua. And the country is miserable. They say no high. We don't have everything. There are shortages of everything. The country is suffering. But U.S. representatives go down there and have a look and come back and go on television and say, you won't believe the place. It's the most miserable country I've ever visited. The Sandinistas have not been able to manage it. Look what happens when you have a Marxist government. To be honest, obviously, they would go down and say, our stated purpose back since 1982 was to break the Nicaraguan economy. We spent $1 billion destabilizing the country to break its economy. Now, here are my snapshots of the results of our successful program to break their economy. Of course, they don't do that because they're playing propaganda, because they're not being honest. The country is miserable. It's not the fault of the Sandinistas. It was the purpose of our Contra program. And then there's the Soviet threat. President Reagan saying all those years, you know, that we were having Soviets in our own backyard. He used to like to say there were Russians flying airplanes in this hemisphere, meaning into Nicaragua, for the first time in all of history. And like much of what he said, you know, his mind didn't work clearly on all three cylinders at best. Like much of what he said, this was not accurate. Anyone who would think for a minute would note that Aeroflot has been flying into Canada, into Mexico, into Latin America, into New York City for 30 or 40 years on a daily basis, not to mention flying in and out of Cuba continuously. So the statement simply was not true. But again, altogether, over this period of time, we spent $1 billion to destabilize this country. You can only weep to think what could have been done with that money to build schools and clinics and irrigation projects in Nicaragua to create a healthy country. To this date, they have not committed an act of war against us or broken relations with us. We could go in now and reverse this program and work with them to alleviate suffering instead of to make people suffer. Now they've sent the Contras back into the country, they being George Bush and the CIA managers. They are still providing them with what they call humanitarian aid, and in a war situation there is no humanitarian aid for the combatants. You're buying uniforms and boots and food for them while private sources give them arms. They've sent several thousand of these troops into the country now to resume the military activities to destabilize the country as it goes into its second election process. And when Ortega has said we can't have a ceasefire if they're killing people in the country as they're doing, then we attack them and say, see, it's all their fault, as we've been doing throughout. This thing that happened in Costa Rica last week, where George Bush was down there for a meeting and he met with Ortega, and Ortega announced that he would have to nullify the ceasefire and put his troops back into trying to maintain the peace, was George Bush's reaction was the ugliest thing, I mean viscerally, in terms of the dignity of a world leader that I recall seeing since Lyndon Johnson was president of this country. As a Texan, I can say that. He was not a graceful man. Bush, with an ugly look on his face, referred to this little man in his green uniform breaking up our garden party. And Ortega eventually replied, and then he kept saying, us democratically elected leaders, and he's coming in here breaking up our garden party. Now, he didn't bother to mention, and I must say the media, working like silly putty to his lead, nobody said at the time, none of the commentators said at the time, but President Bush, do you forget, Ortega was also democratically elected. And no one stood up and said, yes, but people are dying in Nicaragua. What can he do? Instead, George Bush was lashing out at him and continues to do so. And the leading candidate against the Sandinistas, against Ortega in the next elections, is none other than Violeta Chamorro, a longtime CIA agent affiliated with La Prensa newspaper that was on the CIA payroll throughout the 80s, like Anastasio Somoza, Napoleon Duarte in El Salvador, Roberto Dubison in El Salvador, Manuel Noriega in Panama, the Shah of Iran, Mobutu in Zaire. This woman is a CIA agent who is now being run for open office in Nicaragua. Meanwhile, moving on from Nicaragua to the rest of the world, but keeping all of this in mind as a case study, every covert operation, of course, rationalized in terms of national security or anti-communism. We've got lots and lots and lots of these out in the public record. The world is only so big, these things are never completely secret. You can read for yourselves at great length about these things. We've set out to overthrow functioning constitutional democracies in over 20 countries. We manipulated elections in dozens of countries. We created standing armies and directed them to fight. We went after to organize ethnic minorities to encourage them to revolt. The first thing we did in Nicaragua was to go to the Mosquito Indians, who had never gotten along with the other people in Nicaragua very well, and give them more money than they had seen in the entirety of history, and arms and training and rationales and sanctuaries in Honduras, and sent them into Nicaragua to attack, kill, fight, rape, burn, pillage. And this is an insidious thing. Every society is torn with racial conflicts and conflicts with minorities. Think how violent our nation is. Think what if there were a superpower so big that we didn't dare even flap back or strike back at them, that were coming to our minorities with huge sums of money and arms and training people from our minority groups and sending them into the country to do open acts of violence. How we would rise up and the bloodbath that would ensue. And this has been a technique the CIA has used in Nicaragua, in Thailand, in Vietnam, in Laos, in the Congo, in Iran, Iraq with the Kurds, in different parts of the world. We created, trained, and funded death squads like the Treasury Police in El Salvador that are responsible for killing as many as 70,000 people, according to the count of the Catholic Church. And we've assassinated world leaders, including the United States president in 1963, and I'll get to that in more detail in just a moment. Getting back to the subject of democracy, since that's something that Bush and everyone is talking about right now, I remind you of Chile. In 1973, the CIA organized the overthrow of Salvador Allende, the democratically elected president of Chile. And he was killed in the process, and we killed General Schneider, who was the pro-U.S. defender of the Constitution there, in order to put the CIA's representative Pinochet in power. And Henry Kissinger's, when he was grilled by the Congress over this program, his rationale was, yes, the issues are much too important for the Chilean voters to be left to decide for themselves. Now, there was a long CIA destabilization and propaganda campaign against China. We were parachuting teams from Quemoy, Matsu, Tibet, Burma, Thailand, to destabilize China with the propaganda campaign, the propaganda aimed at the United States as well as China and other parts of the world, until eventually we talked ourselves into the Korean War, in which a million people were, where we fought China in Korea and a million people were killed. There was a long CIA destabilization and propaganda campaign against Vietnam, until we talked ourselves into going into Vietnam to fight and 2 million people were killed. Again, read for yourselves. Read Bill Blum's book, The CIA, A Forgotten History. Read Portrait of a Cold Warrior by Joseph Burkholder Smith, who was a CIA case officer in Southeast Asia. Read Fire in the Lake by Frances Fitzgerald, the daughter of Desmond Fitzgerald, the famous CIA chief of operations of Southeast Asia. Read Deadly Deceits by Ralph McGeehy, another case officer who served in Southeast Asia. Read Decent Interval by Frank Snapp, who covered the period of time in Vietnam, 73, 75. He and I were colleagues there at that time. Or if you will, read my own book, In Search of Enemies by Norton, which remains the only insider's detailed account of the inner functionings of a covert action. Or read Washington's War on Nicaragua by Holly Sklar, not written by an insider, but a remarkable detail on the Nicaraguan operation, great detail of how that operation has been run. Trying to come to grips with these CIA activities and these broad numbers, trying to figure out how many people have been killed. You can count it up different ways. You can never be sure how many people are killed in the jungles of Laos or the hills of Nicaragua. But adding them up as best we can, we come up with a figure of 6 million people killed, minimum figure. It has to be more than that. 1 million in the Korean War, 2 million in the Vietnam War, 800,000 in Indonesia, a couple of million in Cambodia, 20,000 in Angola, the operation I was part of, 22,000 in Nicaragua, again a figure the New York Times cites. You're dealing with large numbers of people who died who would not have died if our tax dollars had not been spent by the CIA to exacerbate situations and destabilize and set people to fighting. So you began to analyze these figures to figure out who are these 6 million people we've killed. And again, that's a minimum figure. The conservatives tell us it's a dangerous world. Our enemies have to die so we can be safe and secure. Some of them say, I'm sorry about that, but that's the way the world is. We have to accept this reality. So you begin to study these things and rip through them and analyze them and break them apart, and you find some shocking common denominators come out to you. Namely, for example, since 1954, we do not parachute teams into the Soviet Union to destabilize the country in a brutal way. Coincidentally, 1954 was the first year the Soviets developed their actual capability of actually dropping atomic weapons on the United States. For other reasons, we don't do these things in England, France, Sweden, Norway, Belgium, Switzerland, etc. These things are all done in countries of the third world where the governments don't have the power to force the United States to stop destabilizing the country and brutalizing their people. These 6 million people killed are people of the Mitumba Mountains of the Congo and the jungles of Southeast Asia and the hills of northern Nicaragua. Conspicuously, they're people who don't have ICBMs or armies or navies. They don't have any capability of doing physical hurt to the United States. The 22,000 killed in Nicaragua, for example, they're conspicuously not Russians. They're not Cuban soldiers or advisors. They're not even percentage-wise mostly Sandinistas. They're mostly rag-poor peasants, including a high percentage of women and children. Communists? I'm sorry, they're mostly Roman Catholics. Enemies of the United States? I can't give you that one either, because we have all these witnesses who've gone down to live in their villages with them, and they invariably come back to testify that the Nicaraguans are the warmest people on the face of the earth, and they love people from the United States. And they simply cannot understand why we would want, our leaders would want to rationalize spending $1 billion on a contra force to go into their villages to kill them and mutilate them while their families are forced to watch. Meanwhile, CIA activities, of course, have left their own permanent mark on U.S. society. The MK Ultra program, I'll talk about it in greater detail if you like in the question and answer. We don't have full detail about this, but we have enough to know enough to be thoroughly chilled by it. The pro-agency book, The Agency, by John Rainley, which is the memoirs of CIA founders Larry Houston, Ray Klein, and others, says that there were 175 different projects in that one program. We know of about five of them. These were experimentations with swine fever, with dengue fever, with deadly diseases, with psychedelic drugs, on American population groupings, without their permission in many cases. If you were reading the newspapers in October of 1988, you noticed that there was a settlement declared between the CIA and the victims at McGill University in Canada, where the CIA had been working with a mad psychiatrist who was taking the patients who came to him for help and shooting them up with hallucinogenic drugs to experiment with their minds instead of healing them. And this was a CIA program for which, with your tax dollars, we eventually paid damages to the victims. Read for yourselves again. As I say, read The Agency by John Rainley. Read Clouds of Secrecy by Leonard Cole, a professor from Rutgers, and you find that this program is still going on today. Read In Search of the Manchurian Candidate by John Marks, published by New York Times Press in 1979, based on 14,000 documents gotten out of the CIA under the Freedom of Information Act, or go through the back issues of Covert Action Information Bulletin, which has a dozen solid articles about this program. Colonel White, one of the founders of this program, one of the founders of the CIA, retiring about the time I went in the mid-60s, wrote from retirement a letter to a friend and then agreed to have it published. Why not, he said. And so we have it in his handwriting. He wrote, I toiled wholeheartedly in the vineyards because it was fun, fun, fun. Where else could a red-blooded American boy lie, kill, cheat, steal, rape, and pillage with the blessings of the All-Highest? Then we have the MH Chaos program and the COINTELPRO program, CIA and FBI programs, where they were manipulating student and labor organizations and civic organizations, disrupting them, trying to redirect them. We have the findings of the Church Committee that they were getting journalists, up to about 200 journalists, including some of the biggest names in the business, and getting them to cooperate with the CIA to put its propaganda into our media so that we would be influenced with misunderstandings of what was happening in Southeast Asia, or Korea, or Vietnam, or China, or Central America, other parts of the world that our government wanted to destabilize and attack and fight wars. Co-opting professors to work with the CIA to manipulate student groups and build files on students. Publishing 1,200 books in which they were paying professors, scholars, journalists to write books in their names. And these books are still in our libraries today because the Church Committee couldn't force the CIA to reveal the titles, CIA propaganda, so that if you're doing your dissertation on the Vietnam War, for example, probably one or two dozen of the books that you'll have in your bibliography, if not more, will in fact be CIA propaganda, and you can only guess and try to discern which is which. And this is not ancient history. FBI Director William Sessions announced about this time last year that he was disciplining officers that he found had been improperly targeting CSPIS and 160 other civic organizations. And this summer, the Congressional Committee said there were a total of 1,600 groups that had been targeted and listed, as they say, improperly by the FBI. Again, the same type of programs as the MHKS and COINTELPRO programs. And that's just FBI. The CIA was doing the same thing during the same period of time, but there's been no confession or revelation of what they were doing. Nor has there been a publication of the lists of the names of the groups that were targeted. So if you had trouble in one of your groups, you can only guess if it was because of FBI or CIA disruption or just pure and simply human foible. Drugs. Every major area of operation in which the CIA has worked has left behind a major functioning drug cartel. Again, this is a major subject we could talk about all night. I'll just mention it. We can go back to it in detail if you like in the question and answer. The French connection grew directly from the OSS, the CIA's predecessors, getting Lucky Luciano out of prison and funding him to activate the mafia to work with the U.S. forces during the war and then right after the war to break up the strikes on the docks in Marseille. The Golden Triangle in Southeast Asia grew directly out of our covert policies there before it had been run by French intelligence with the Corsican Mafia. We took over with our Air America and civil air transport planes flying in arms to our allies, flying back out with the heroin, the first target being U.S. GIs during the Vietnam War, the second target being the United States itself. The Golden Crescent. Afghanistan, of course, is the largest covert operation the CIA has run to date. We understand in terms of the hundreds of millions of dollars it's cost, going on for over a year, and sure enough, after about 6 years, the Golden Crescent in that area becomes the largest source of heroin in the world today. And then again, to mention the Medellin Colombian cocaine cartel getting the big surge of its activities during the 80s, the importation of cocaine in 1981, according to the DEA, being 1,000 kilograms, jumping to 35,000 kilograms, a little over 35 tons in 1987, while we have, again, the findings of the Kerry Committee, the findings of investigative journalists, the massive overlapping between the Contra program and the Medellin smuggling drugs into this country. The beauty of it being that the Contras, the people who were running the Contra program for the CIA, were eminently corruptible, and the planes would fly down with arms and come back to our National Guard and Air Force bases where they had CIA clearances. So they could land at Homestead and then have passes to, you know, load onto the trucks and clear the bases without being stopped. And when they would be stopped, or someone like Leon Kellner, the attorney down in Florida trying to prosecute, word would come down from the Attorney General's office to tell them that it was national security, that they should not try to prosecute this thing. Even Adolfo Calero's brother-in-law caught involved in the importation of 200 kilograms of cocaine into this country and not prosecuted again because they said it involved U.S. national security, namely the destabilization of Nicaragua. If you'd like to get your information from video, see Guns, Drugs, and the CIA, the Frontline PBS show, or read for yourselves. Read The Great Heroin Coup by Heinrich Krueger. Read The Iran-Contra Connection by Peter Dale Scott. Read The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia by Al McCoy. Read The Cocaine Wars by Paul Eddy. Read Out of Control by Leslie Coburn. Read Mafia Kingfish by John Davis. Read The Senator Must Die by Bob Morrow. 80% of the people in this country have been polled for some time when they're pinned down, do you believe that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone in killing John Kennedy, or was there a conspiracy? 80% of the people have been saying there had to be a conspiracy. But we were saying this without having the facts, without being able to say what kind of a conspiracy, who was behind it. Now we have the facts out in abundant detail. This, by the spring of 1963, the liberal President John Kennedy had antagonized a number of powerful and very ugly forces in this country. The CIA's O.P. Mongoose J.M. Wave group out of Florida that had been attacking Cuba like the Contras in Nicaragua with lots of atrocities and vicious activities and a program to assassinate leaders including Fidel Castro, they hated Kennedy because the Bay of Pigs fiasco, although it was their fault, it was bungled, they blamed him for not sending in the Marines to bail them out. And they hated him for that, and they hated him for making a deal with the Russians to have the Russian missiles withdrawn from Cuba with the promise that we would not invade Cuba. And also at the same time, because of that deal, Kennedy was shutting down their destabilization contra-type program going from Florida into Cuba, and they hated him for that. They were very angry, and they were armed, and they were practiced and trained at military-type ambushes. The right-wing military was angry because Kennedy had decided to pull us out of the Vietnam War. The conservative Dallas businessmen were angry because he was moving to terminate the oil depletion allowances that had made them so terrifically rich over a period of years. The Deep South was becoming enraged because this was an era of deep segregation, and he was beginning to say, we got to let go, we've got to loosen up, we've got to stop the segregation in the South. And some very heavy people were very angry and fighting, killing mad about that. And the mafia was embattled. John Kennedy, the president, and his brother, Bobby, the attorney general, had for years been waging a war against the mafia, trying to put the leaders in jail, throwing Carlos Marcello, the Don from New Orleans, out of the country, going after them in a serious, systematic way. And it turned out that there were numerous threats and indications of the mafia's plans to kill the Kennedy brothers, the war, as they saw it, between themselves and the Kennedy brothers. So what happened was a team of what they call CIA renegades, because it wasn't the coat and tie people inside the building like myself and David McMichael, I think, is sitting in the back, CIA officers who were of the establishment inside. It was the renegades down in Florida who were working this destabilization activity against Cuba, working with Cuban exiles, overlapping greatly with the mafia, which was involved in this flow of drugs from Cuba into the United States. These people plotted a military-style ambush in Dallas, and they set up a team of shooters on the top of buildings. They had the cooperation of someone in the Secret Service. They had the cooperation of the Dallas police. They got the parade route redirected. They got Kennedy into this, the cars into this place where we would have to make a 120-degree turn. The Secret Service driver stopped when the bullets began flying. And anyone who's been through that kind of training, and I've been through their bang and burn courses, they drill it into you that when the bullets start flying in a situation like you have a president or yourself or something, you mash down on the gas and you get the hell out of there, you don't stop and look around as this seasoned Secret Service driver did, in fact. And Kennedy was shot down short distances from shooting stations, probably four of them, firing probably seven shots. He was hit twice, once in the back, once in the front of the neck, and twice in the head. Connolly was hit once or twice. Two bullets were fired on each side of the thing. The convoy then blasted away and got out of there. Immediately, the FBI launched the cover-up, the announced purpose by the people in the establishment being to prove, to reassure, as they put it, the nation, that it was the work of the lone assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald. The evidence was tampered with massively. The president's body was altered. The photographs of the autopsy were altered. And 49 witnesses were killed so they could not blow the whistle and testify and blow this thing open. Until this day, despite the fact that the House Committee in 1979 concluded that it was a conspiracy, there has been no formal investigation by the Justice Department of the conspiracy to kill our president. This was nothing less than a coup d'etat. They, the conservatives, the ones that hated John Kennedy, were faced with his reelection and possibly his brother's after that, and they could not be bothered to wait for democracy to take its course, so they plotted an ambush, and they killed him. And their choice, a man who was playing ball with them, who was accepting money from the mob, Lyndon Johnson, moved right into the presidency. And the oil depletion allowance, the Vietnam War, the essential things they wanted, they got immediately. The crusade against organized crime was dropped, and world went on as they wanted it to, according to their wishes, without their having to bother with an election. Read for yourselves. We've got a number of meticulously researched books out on the market now, and a bunch of people who are determined to bring this out and finally, 2.5 decades later, make it clear to the people that the government must sooner or later face the truth and go after and punish the people who are responsible for assassinating our president. Read High Treason by Grodin and Livingston. Read The Senator Must Die or Betrayal by Bob Morrow. Read On the Trail of the Assassin by Jim Garrison. Read Contract on America, the bestseller that's afoot today by David Scheim. Read Mafia Kingfish by John Davids. Read Gumshoe by Josiah Thompson. Read Reasonable Doubt by H. Hurt. Read Best Evidence by David Lifton. Read Secrecy and Power, The Life of J. Edgar Hoover by Richard Powers. Among other things, you'll find that J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI director, was a major hoodlum. He was the master of blackmail in this country. Everyone in Washington knew it. He was building files on senators and congresspeople. If they crossed him, they would be exposed. If they tried to force an investigation of the FBI, they would be exposed personally. If they tried to force investigations of the mafia, they would be exposed. Richard Nixon had mob ties dating back to his first election campaign in California. Lyndon Johnson, anyone down in Texas could tell you that his campaigns were very dirty. And now we come to the breathtaking scandal of having this man, Manuel Noriega, who's a former paid CIA agent under six presidents. That's according to George Bush. He revealed that information in the presidential debates with Michael Dukakis. This man, Noriega, the dictator of Panama, an indicted drug dealer, boasting that he has blackmail control over George Bush, the United States president. I refer you to the Newsweek May 23, 1988 issue, in which it's about Noriega. It concludes with Noriega's quote, quotation marks, "I have George Bush by the balls." This may help you understand why, of all the dictators in the world who are smuggling drugs, who are not very nice, who have manipulated elections, why George Bush has a fixation on Noriega. He's got a problem there. He's got to keep the pressure on Noriega, else if Noriega ever got some credibility working, who knows what might happen in our own legal system up here. I worked for George Bush personally at the end of the Angolan operation when he was CIA director in 1976. We had broken the law and we had perjured ourselves to cover it up. We being Henry Kissinger and Bill Colby, mostly me being in a staff position under them. Bush's policies were not to find out the truth and punish the perpetrators and clean up the CIA. It was to cover for us. He went to the congressional committees and said, "I wasn't here, but these nice people I'm meeting," he's a very nice person, by the way. He would walk down the hall shaking our hands saying, "Hello, I'm George Bush, and I want you to know I love being here working with all these fine people in the CIA." And we were saying, "Huh?" I mean, this is the CIA director is supposed to have kind of an aura, you know. But he was going to the Congress saying, "I can't believe that these nice people out there would do the things that you're alleging, but I'll check." And then he had... a young attorney sent down to my office to go through my files to purge them of documents that would prove exactly what they were accusing us of. And then he went back to them and said, "We've checked. There are no files in the agency that prove anything like you're alleging. Therefore, you can drop it." And they did. In the Orlando Letelier killing, this is a bombing in Washington Square in our capital done by CIA or former CIA agents with DINA agents from the Chilean service. He immediately went to the Justice Department and asked them to soft-pedal it because he said it involved sensitive relationships with other countries, meaning the service in Chile, a bombing in this capital, and he wants to cover it up. He also went to the veterans of the Opie Mongoose destabilization of Cuba. When Johnson had shut that program down, or Kennedy had shut it down and Johnson had let it die, these people had turned to drug smuggling and murder and bombing, shooting bazookas at ships coming into the Miami Harbor, stuff like that, out of control. He went to them and said, look, the pressure is mounting. You've got to get your act out of the country. And in June of 76, they went to the Dominican Republic and had a meeting and formed this Coru group, planning their activities, counter-revolutionary unit. And in October 6 of 1976, they blew up an airplane that was taking off from Barbados, killing 73 passengers on board in a raw act of terrorism. Luis Posada Carillas and Orlando Bosch were jailed in Venezuela for being the authors of that bombing. We have classified testimony before the Senate Church Committee and before the House Assassination Committee that Orlando Bosch was also a member of the team that killed President Kennedy. And in the Iran-Contra scandal, we have a very curious and awesome and awful situation where the vice president was supposedly in charge of an anti-drug task force, where he got involved in the Contra program, where he had this man, Don Gregg, a longtime CIA officer working as his national security advisor. And Gregg had a relationship with Felix Rodriguez, who was one of the Bay of Pigs veterans, one of the drug smuggling, destabilizing people working against Cuba, who was with Don Gregg and MR3 in Vietnam, my military region in Vietnam, although we did not overlap there. They were there before I got there. Bush has Don Gregg working for him, and they place Felix Rodriguez in Ilopango in El Salvador, where he's in charge of, and we have the documents proving that he was involved in primarily working with the Contra Air Force, and these were the planes that were flying the drugs, the arms to the Contras, and the drugs back to the United States. We have testimony before our courts and evidence in the trial of Millán Rodríguez that they delivered, they being Millán, laundering money for the Medellín, delivered $10 million to the Contras through Felix Rodriguez, buying access to this air wing. Now, these people got Luis Posada Carillas out of prison in Venezuela. Felix Rodriguez told the press, he said, we needed him. He's a good man. And they got Luis Posada Carillas out of Venezuela to help them with this program. And this man was the terrorist who was involved in blowing up the passenger plane that was taking off from Barbados. And he's working for Felix Rodriguez, who is reporting directly to the vice president's office, Vice President George Bush's office, and flying up to report in person and going into Bush's office to report. Bush says he doesn't remember they're ever talking about the Contra program or anything down in Central America. They were talking about their lunch or dinner or something. See, the trouble with this is that with Ronald Reagan, you really could believe that he didn't understand when people briefed him. The man's mind skipped in and out, as everyone well knew. But George Bush is an intelligence person. It's very difficult to believe that he would not be mentally involved in these things. But even if by chance they did talk about lunch or breakfast, when it became clear, we brought it out in the media vigorously, and the Congress discussed it, that a known terrorist was working one step up the chain or down the chain of command from him, reporting into his office, he did not purge himself of these associations. To the contrary, he went on and nominated Don Gregg to be ambassador to Korea, where I believe he is today. One might speculate, going back to Noriega's boast, that George Bush could not separate himself from these people because of what they would know of their involvement with him, going back to the CIA days and to the activities when he was vice president working with them. Looking at George Bush's policies now, he's been in office a few months and we can begin to measure the personality of his presidency. He's maintaining a slightly lower, less noisy profile than Ronald Reagan, but he's continuing his policies across the globe. Bush has refused the Soviets' offer for both superpowers to abstain from delivering arms to the combatants in Afghanistan. He has asked for military aid for the Contras in Nicaragua so they could continue fighting.